It's just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Last night in Houston, ABC and Univision put on the third Democratic presidential primary debate, the first such debate in which everyone who made it to the debate stage made it to the same debate stage. That led to a night of contrast, particularly between the three candidates in the top tranche of polling results: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. Early on in the debate, Biden came out swinging at the universal single-payer health care proposal that both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are lined up behind. Here's a little bit of what that sounded like.
There will be a deductible in your paycheck. You're going to, the middle class person, someone making 60 grand with three kids, they're going to end up paying $5,000 more. They're going to end up paying 4% more on their income tax. That's a reality. Now, it's not a bad idea if you like it. I don't like it.
Okay, now I want everybody to keep to the time, but you did invoke both senators. I have to get responses from them, and then
sure,
we will go on out.
Good.
Senator Warren, you go first.
So let's be clear. I've actually never met anybody who likes their health insurance company. I've met people who like their doctors. I've met people who like their nurses. I've met people who like their pharmacists. I've met people who like their physical therapists. What they want is access to health care.
Later in the night, Biden took some blows of his own over the record of the Obama administration on immigration. Here he is taking questions from Univision host Jorge Ramos.
Vice President Biden, as a presidential candidate in 2008, you supported the border wall, saying, unlike most Democrats, I voted for 700 miles of fence. This is what you said. Then you served as vice president in an administration that deported 3 million people, the most ever in U.S. history. Did you do anything to prevent those deportations? I mean, you've been asked this question before and refused to answer, so let me try once again. Are you prepared to say tonight that you and President Obama made a mistake about deportations? Why should Latinos trust you?
What Latinos should look at is comparing this president to the president we have is outrageous. Number one, we didn't lock people up in cages. We didn't separate families. We didn't do all of those things. Number one.
I should point out that at this point in the debate, the Twitter accounts of immigration reporters all the country over exploded with people fact-checking that remark, pointing out that everybody in a family who the Obama administration detained for deportation was in fact separated from their family, and that the photos that went viral in 2018 of children in cages were in fact photos from 2014 from the Obama administration. Joining us to go through the debate, what it augurs for the rest of the campaign, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Your big takeaways from last night's debate?
It was a good debate. You know, none of them are perfect, and it's always hard when you've got this many candidates on stage. But I thought that it was generally a very issue-focused debate, and you really saw, I think, more and more the strengths and weaknesses of the candidates. I give immense credit to Jorge Ramos, the questioner from, obviously, from Univision, who's, frankly, he did what a moderator ought to do. He asked tough questions that gave candidates an opportunity to seize the moment, to show their skills, to show what they can do. And I was powerfully struck. He asked Bernie Sanders a very tough question about Venezuela. Sanders came back and gave, I thought, a very strong answer as regards the difference between an authoritarian approach and democratic socialism as he sees it. He asked Cory Booker about veganism, right? Whether he had to give up meat. And Booker answered and then turned it into a really good, deep discussion, a rare discussion in our debates about factory farming. And then he had this remarkable exchange with Biden, where he pressed Biden aggressively on immigration, and where I think some of the candidates really showed strength in responding to the questions. I think in this case, Biden really struggled. And it was interesting that at a key point, Ramos brought Julian Castro in And you saw some very, very intense exchanges there. That's what debates should be, frankly. I mean, you can have favorites, you can have, you know, people you like, dislike, and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, candidates should be challenged, and they should show their stuff or the lack thereof.
But what news actually got broken on that debate stage last night, beyond Andrew Yang promising that his campaign is going to start paying $1,000 a month to 10 Americans chosen at random?
And one of the most remarkable moments in American debate history, I might add, that he literally rendered a stage of candidates with a billion talking points prepared speechless for a moment.
Kamala Harris laughed hard and long.
Kamala Harris, to her credit, laughed hard and long. It's not that I disagree with some of the ideas that Yang is putting into the debate. I think actually it's very good. I just don't think the way he's doing it is perhaps the most effective. But remember, Pete Buttigieg had to do the next one, and he was just like, he just kind of shook his head for a while. So there was that. I can tell you the news right now. It was Beto O'Rourke's answer to the question about assault weapons.
Hell yeah, we're going to take your AR-15s.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to live. months from now, that clip is still going to live and be mentioned and be a standard that other candidates are measured against. It doesn't mean that O'Rourke, you know, is necessarily going to, you know, shoot up the polls or even be the nominee or something like that. But what it does mean is he captured that. And you know, this is in a debate. What's powerful is if a question is answered or a question is asked and answered, right? You know, it's like, yeah, what do you think about this stuff? And bam, there you had it. So that's a very newsworthy moment, I mean, in the classic sense. The other thing that I think was significant is this effort by Biden, and you highlighted it right up front there, this effort by Biden to make the distinction between himself and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And it was actually a rather artfully prepared statement right at the start of the debate, clearly one that they thought about a little bit, where he said of Elizabeth Warren, you know, she's with Bernie, I'm with, paraphrasing here, but she's with Bernie, I'm with Barack. That's an interesting gambit. I understand what Biden is trying to do, but as happened later on the immigration issue and some other issues during the course of the debate, if you go there, you've also got to deal with the next round of questioning you get. And I'll give you one final news element from this debate, at least to my view. I think that if we write the history of this campaign at the end of it, and we look at, you know, kind of who had a strategy through these debates, it's very clear to me now that Elizabeth Warren has a strategy. And her strategy is evolving. With each debate, she seeks to achieve different things. It's almost as if she's sort of saying, okay, I've got this platform. I know I'm going to be here with these other people. I'll do exchanges with them. But there's something I want to accomplish. And tonight, or last night, if you listened, she put on the table again and again and again, very powerful personal narrative. She told about herself and as a teacher, as a young lawyer, and then she brought that into the issue she's talking about. It was effective, and I've got to bet that, you know, not everybody watches debates, but I will bet that people who watch the debates will come away with a more positive view of Elizabeth Warren. So that was effective.
And that's basically taken whole cloth from her stump speech, which very much does what you just described.
Totally.
Explains who she is, where she comes from, connects it to the issue she cares about, and why she thinks running for president is the best way to advance them.
I thought she did that. But one final thing I will add, too. I do think Senator Harris did a very good job last night of even taking some tough questions, which I think she handled pretty capably. But she did a really good job of giving a sense of what she might be like in a debate with Donald Trump, especially in her opening statement where, you know, she basically just turned to the camera and said, yeah, I'm going to talk to Donald Trump for a little bit here. And it was pointed. It was strong. And I do think that in a debate where a lot of people tried to identify themselves as the distinctive challenger to a Donald Trump, that she did a very good job on that.
Yeah, I'm curious of what you make about the fact that the tenor of this debate's Kamala Harris excluded has largely moved from I'm the person who can defeat Donald Trump to here's what I actually stand for in the direction I'd like to move the country in. Do you think it's a product of the fact that the polls are now consistently showing anybody in the top half of the Democratic pack was polling well ahead of Donald Trump in a theoretical matchup?
I think there is an element of that, because if Democrats are confident that they can beat Donald Trump in 2020, and we could have a long discussion, Brian, about whether they should be confident. I think there's still a lot of challenges and a lot of issues to keep in mind. But if they are increasingly confident that can occur, then they get to enter into a much more robust discussion about, okay, we're going to get this office. What do we want to do with it? And how do we best capitalize on this moment? Do we do it by trying to marginally beat him, a little better than he is, or maybe a lot better, but not really a militant campaign? Or do you go for it all? Do you really try to have a wave election, Roosevelt 32, Reagan 1980? And that is an important question, because, it's funny, I've been working on a book about the Democratic Party and looking back at moments of accomplishment, but also moments missed. And one of the interesting things is that in 1976, after Watergate, Vietnam War, so many changes, Democrats had a pretty good sense that they were going to win the presidency in 1976. And their nominee ended up being Jimmy Carter, who in that race was actually a pretty moderate, relatively cautious figure as compared to some of the other candidates. And now Carter has become a much venerated figure, a very respected figure. But at the time, there were many Democrats who said, look, we didn't nominate a fighter. We didn't nominate somebody who could really seize the office and do something with it. And made the argument that Carter challenged in the primaries of 1980 that was going to haunt the party, that there were going to be missed opportunities. And I do think that's maybe too much history, but at the heart of it is this notion that Democrats now, looking at the opportunity they have, also then begin to look at the question of what are we going to do with this if we get it?
I want to talk about
the candidates are trying to seize. Yeah,
the opportunities the campaign presents for non-candidates to kind of move the bounds of political discourse. On the stage, you had Beto O'Rourke saying, hell yeah, you're going to take your AR-15s. In the audience, you had a group of protesters who burst out at least twice, the most intense portion of the debate, bringing proceedings grounding to halt for about a minute. Let's listen to a little bit of that. So it's hard to understand, but they start off by saying, we are DACA recipients. It's a group of student protesters. This is at the University of Houston. One of them was wearing a T-shirt that called for citizenship for all and abolition of immigration and customs enforcement. It made me think back to the 2012 re-election campaign of Barack Obama, when a number of Dreamers, young people who've been brought to the United States as children, kind of moved the bounds of policy by early in the campaign doing direct actions, occupying Obama re-election campaign offices and forcing the administration to take action on immigration, what ultimately wound up being DACA in the face of a Congress that was unwilling to do anything of substance.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a part of politics, right? And it's a valid part of politics. I mean, so much of our electioneering, if you will, is theatrical. It is separated from the people. It is the big debate stage. It is the TV ad. It's the interview. It's the manufactured appearance before, a very friendly rally. And that is a part of politics, and we accept that as reality. But there's a long history of using these moments, these high-profile moments, to put an issue on the table. And frankly, I think at this point, after some of the things we have seen over the last year, putting issues of ICE on the table, this movement to abolish ICE, which, by the way, a number of members of Congress support, is something that's valid, of course. But more than that, it demands questions. It demands inquiry. And frankly, I wouldn't have minded if the moderators had said, boy, these people are yelling about this. Let's go for it and ask some questions. It's more questions. They did some good immigration questions, but to go deeper. I know moderators don't like that because then they think, well, we're always going to have somebody yelling a question, or they'll be, they will in their own minds lose control of the event. But I don't necessarily, I don't think that's always a bad thing. I think that sometimes you have this popular outcry. And you go back to 2012, I'll go back even further. And if we remember the HIV/AIDS crisis, the earlier stages where there really wasn't an appropriate or sufficient response, ACT UP, the group ACT UP, really interrupted a lot of events. They challenged a lot of candidates at press conferences and other appearances to address the issue and to get serious about it. And my sense is that those challenges to Democrats and Republicans, to friends, quote unquote, and folks who hadn't been as friendly on the issue, moved things in an urgent moment in a very effective way. So I do think, there are many ways that one seeks to influence the politics. I'd also note people seeking to force a climate debate right now have used a lot of strategies and tactics to try and raise the issue. And frankly, I think they're right. And I happen to think it frustrates me, even though CNN did a pretty good climate hearing, if you will, where the candidates got to speak. I still think a debate on that issue, and frankly, more targeted debates. I guess I don't get why, when we're going to have debate after debate after debate, why we don't say, the next debate is going to be a climate debate. And the debate after that is going to be criminal justice reform. And the debate after that is going to be immigration. And the debate after that is going to be war and peace. Where you focus them. Until you get down to, two candidates, on the eve of the California primary sitting at a table because everybody else has been eliminated. And I don't, by the way, think we'll necessarily get there. But until you get to that point, I think you can have issue-focused debates. And there's something very healthy and strong about that.
Well, speaking of the climate issue, let's talk about the kind of stage going into the fourth debate, which is right around the corner. It's going to be added a new entrant is entering the fray. That is California billionaire Tom Steyer, who is making climate change a central component of his campaign. He's basically been able to buy his way into the primary pretty late in the game by buying a lot of ads to rack up a lot of small donations to put him over the threshold and get him to penetrate a couple of the polls as required to qualify. Mm-hmm. Do you see anything significantly changing?
I think it's significant that the next debate will have more candidates on stage. And that Steyer is one of them. I think there's also at least a chance that Tulsi Gabbard comes across, and maybe another candidate. So, which, Brian, raises a really unsettling thought in my mind. We could go back to two-stage debates, two-night debates, because there's so many candidates. The Democrats have said if you're over 10, you're going to go to two stages. And that, I don't think, is at this point a particularly healthy game. I would argue if you had one or two more candidates, even as hard as it is, you should try and keep them, on the same stage the same night. I also think a three-hour or better part of three-hour debate, as you had last night, is challenging. And so you might want to look at...
Ooh, it seemed challenging for Joe Biden.
Yes, it did. And so with that said, your core question was about Tom Steyer. And I think it's healthy he's coming in. Yeah, he's very focused on climate and on immigration. I don't, frankly, like the idea of anyone buying their way onto the stage. And I've not been a fan from the start of the model the Democrats have come up with here. I mean, I'm not saying that I've got a better model, so I'm guilty of that. But, at some fundamental level, I think that, you're probably not going to buy your way onto that stage because you don't have the kind of money that some people have. And I think that's a barrier I don't really like. With that said, I've interviewed Steyer. He's a very deep thinker on a lot of these issues. He's a serious man. And he could theoretically play a vital role in the next debate, especially, frankly, if he focuses hard on two of the issues he's been very big on, climate and impeachment. The problem with that is I'm not sure how much doing that advances his candidacy, right? It may get people excited about him on those issues, but it's a complexity of coming in as a single issue or a dual issue candidate, as Andrew Yang, frankly, has to some extent seen.
Yeah, it's hard to run your campaign for president on the platform of we need to impeach the guy I intend to defeat before I get a chance to defeat him.
It is a complicated, but you see, Brian, this gets us back to the point we may have started with, which is that in a debate, you get challenged. Perhaps that precise question is asked, right? And it's your skill at answering it, right? Can you make the case? And frankly, I, as one who happen to be very supportive of the use of constitutional responses to constitutional crises, think you can make a debate or an argument for impeaching this president at this time. Hmm. It's just how well you do it.
All right, John Nichols, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Total honor and pleasure to be with you.
John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. That takes us to 7:30. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Coming up in a few minutes, Janine Etter takes a look at the origins of our myths about today's date, Friday the 13th. That's after these news headlines with Max Pringle.